every time we seem to get some type of settled or stability, someone from City Hall or PDC or somewhere else, someone else decides, well, it's time to move him again. Most people don't draw a historical continuum so that you can parallel this, and they want you to see it in little bits and pieces but not put it all together. But this is nothing new.
People have been organizing in North and Northeast, I mean, black people and low-income people, for decades. They've been approaching the city hall asking for these changes. It didn't happen. Institutionalized racism, that's why it's not happening. And that's why this money is going into the neighborhoods now, because of the white influx.
Roots is looking back in the 1960s when they rioted on Albina, and back in the 1970s when the building of Memorial Coliseum and the expansion of Emmanuel, and say, okay, the system will continually move us, displace us at their convenience and at their whim. When the opportunity of progress has come into full view, and they say, oh, we have a lot of these dollars and we can start breaking ground, well, how do we get these people out? It's not really a question of how, it's just when. When they make up their mind and there's no one pulling their coattails saying, you need to put some more thought in this, you need to come talk to us, you're about to move us out of our nexus, out of our homes, out of our epicenters of life, you know, we just can't let you do that. That's what we have to get back to.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, part two of our gentrification special. In our exploration of this complex topic of gentrification, we felt it was very important to include often overlooked history. We spoke with Obi Hill, historian and owner of Reflections Bookstore on North Killingsworth and Williams Avenue in Portland. Obi spent part of his childhood in Vanport and was displaced by the Memorial Day flood of 1948. He shared stories of Portland at that time and illustrated how the continuum of instability that has faced African Americans in this country is still very obvious today. In the second half of our show tonight, we spoke with Charles Bishop and Charles Santos of Roots, Reclaiming Our Origins Through Struggle. This is a Portland-based group. They talked to us about their lives growing up in North and Northeast Portland and all the changes that they've seen take place there in their lifetime. We also talked with Angel Williamson of White Allies Against Racism, which is a project of Roots. Stay tuned to this second part of Circle A Radio and stay informed.
This is Michael Greger from Portland State University.
If we go back to the original Constitution of Oregon, it actually barred blacks from even entering the state, and it was an attempt to try to keep out what the state founders, the Constitution writers, perceived as trouble, with all the ramifications of that word, keep it out of the state. And their idea of keeping that out was to keep it one race, white. In the run-up to the Civil War, there was such a battle for states to be slave or free. And if you think of, you know, Bloody Kansas, for example, with John Brown and such. And that was a big part of why they wanted in Oregon to keep it a completely white state. I think once you've got that white presence or totality, it kind of feeds on itself. And so what happened was, in the inevitable migration that happened in the United States, as it became less tenable by law, try to keep African Americans out of the Northwest, people went into groups like the Ku Klux Klan, which has grew to about 200,000 membership in the 1920s, and that was a more extra legal way to try to keep blacks out, or at least keep them down once they came in. And really, mostly in Oregon, it was to keep them out. There were active attempts in Portland to drive the African American population out of town.
Portland at one time didn't have that many black people. I think prior to the World War, you was hard-pressed to find 2,000 black people in the whole state of Oregon. And that is because there was a deliberate effort made that black people couldn't reside in the state of Oregon.
Portland had a housing authority that made the decision that it did not want these people inside that housing. Plus, there was not much housing at the time. There was an active policy to keep the emphasis on private housing in Portland. And there was a, at that time, even stated policy among realtors to restrict blacks to the Albina region, which is a very small region in Portland. So there was this huge problem. Henry Kaiser had one shipyard that he had started in 1941, and he wanted to open two more, and he simply could not put all these people inside the city.
In August of 1942, Henry Kaiser's son, Edgar Kaiser, announced plans to build a gigantic Portland housing project of 6,000 units, soon increased to 10,000, on a square mile of Columbia River floodplain just north of the Portland city limits. Tenants started moving in 4 months later. A total of 9,942 houses and apartment units were built, eventually occupied by an estimated 42,000 men, women, and children, making Vanport the largest wartime housing project in the United States and the second largest city in Oregon. After World War II, the future of Vanport was a divisive question. Some people advocated converting the site to permanent low-cost housing, and Edgar Kaiser proposed building several hundred permanent dwellings there. However, Portland Mayor Riley and Housing Authority of Portland Chairman Chester Moores wanted Vanport to be demolished immediately and the land used for industrial development. Their private reason was simply they didn't want African Americans staying in Portland. The majority of African Americans who came during the war had quietly settled in Vanport.
My name is O.B. Hill. I was a resident of Vanport as a small child, and I am a refugee of the Vanport flood. Memorial Day, 1948. Sunday morning, my brother and I were outside playing. Maybe it was two of my brothers and I. One, Clarence, was a little younger than me, so he was probably inside. But James, my older brother and I. And the police came by on a motorcycle and had informing us that we have to evacuate because the dike has broken. So we run inside and tell my mother. My father, who was asleep at the time, was awakened also. And we ended up evacuating and leaving him there. It was several days before we saw him again. In fact, we walked out of Vanport up Denver Avenue, and when we got to the top, when we looked back, we saw houses being carried toward us. That's basically what happened on that particular Sunday morning. All this happened in a matter of an hour or so. And we went into Kenton, which is a small area of the city, and ended up staying at, I think it was James John School, which is a grade school in North Portland. I remember what I call moving from pillar to post in my memoirs, that's what I said. Because as a refugee, as a African American, during those particular times, there was covenants in the city in terms of where you could stay. And so Vanport was the second largest city in the state of Oregon. And it was a response to Second World War shipbuilding industry. And it was a city that was basically constructed on behalf of Kaiser, who was a shipbuilder. Today, we don't see Kaiser building ships, but his wife, Bess Kaiser, we know it as Kaiser Permanente Hospital. Vanport is very vivid in my mind, and I'm a product of the child of the flood. There's a lot I could say about it. What I do remember is the difficulty in settling down, and in a lot of ways I'm still unsettled. I'm still moving from pillar to post. My father, who lived in Birmingham, Alabama, along with my mother, he worked on a garbage truck. Some kind of way he ended up in some type of an altercation with a Caucasian male, which ended in a fight, And because of those times, he had to leave Birmingham. He had heard about opportunities in the shipbuilding industry in Portland, Oregon, and actually Vancouver, Washington. So he came up here, and then he sent for us. And that's how we got to Vanport, because of shipyard opportunities. We came up on a couple occasions. In addition to working in the shipyards, he also worked for Southern Pacific Railroad. So we boarded the train and came to the Pacific Northwest from Alabama. And I remember stopping off in Chicago and then ending up in Bagley Downs, which was a housing project in Vancouver, Washington. My mother at the time got pregnant, and was the custom of the day, she went back home to have the child. So my little sister was born at that particular time. So we were back in Birmingham, Alabama. And once she got able to move, then we came back outside of Alabama, moved back to the Pacific Northwest, ended up in Vanport. The type of support system that we had was basically, my father worked, so his wages were what we had. When we left Vanport, my mother had a small portable radio, and so she picked that up and carried that out of the flood with her. Other than that radio, we lost everything except the clothes on our back. Upon finding out that radio had been salvaged from the flood, the store then repossessed that. So we ended up actually with nothing after all those years of my father and mother working in the shipyards. So we had to start over from scratch, which meant that my father had to work two jobs. He worked at Rich Manufacturing Company as a shakeout man, which is a real hard job. That old plant is still out on Columbia Boulevard, but it's not operable anymore. And then he would leave there and he would go to Southern Pacific Roundhouse, right over in the area of where TriMet is now. I really don't believe that people thought there would be a flood, because if so, they didn't have an evacuation plan. And that was the thing about it, because there was at that particular time, Vanport had a substantial black population, and there was not enough housing in the area that people were willing to open up for people just in the event of flood. So there was no plan, I don't believe. And once it happened, then of course, there was a lot of scurrying around to try to get housing for people. And that's why I can relate right now with the people who were victims of the recent Hurricane Katrina. Those people are going to have quite a bit of time recovering from that tragedy.
This is Obie Hill speaking about the Albina neighborhood of Portland during the time of Vanport.
The Albina community at that particular time did not have a lot of black people. However, the majority of them lived in a couple of sections. There were black people living in Northeast Portland between the Steel Bridge and the Broadway Bridge. In the area now is occupied by Memorial Coliseum. That, in that particular time, all the way up to Williams and Russell, these were the heart of the black community. Down in the area of the Coliseum was a lot of black residents, clubs, nightclubs, and small businesses. And it went all the way up to, I would say, Williams and Russell. You had a few people at that time had moved up a little past Fremont. But at that time, 7th Avenue was the cutoff line, and you found very few, if any, black people beyond 7th. The black people were basically relegated to the area around the Coliseum, as I mentioned. The rest of us lived in projects. These were government projects that were built for housing, for shipyard buildings during the war. In regards to moving from pillar to post, I'll tell you some of the projects that I personally lived in as a child. We were in Bagley Downs, and then went back to Birmingham. We came back, and we lived in Vanport. Vanport flooded, and we were able to move in with a Mrs. Thompson in Southeast Portland. Now, there were small pockets throughout the city that had a few black people in it, but it wasn't a high concentration of blacks in the city of Portland at that time. In fact, after the flood, the majority of the people then moved into project houses. St. John's Woods, over in North Portland, separated from Parkside Homes by Pier Park. Swan Island was a lot of military barracks, and they moved people down in there. We lived on Swan Island. We lived in Pheasanton Homes. Fur Court, moved there. We went to St. John's Woods on Oakleaf, and we moved to Maple Leaf. We finally moved into a house from the projects in 1955. So for about 8 years, we swung around from various projects. There were other projects like Columbia Villa that still was in existence at that time. They've gone and torn that down now, and they're making it into condominiums and other type of apartments, but that was a major one. That one was almost reserved for white people, but there were a few black people who lived in those areas too. Vanport can be used as a microcosm for how black people have been continually manipulated and moved in their city of Portland experience. If you look around now, you see the same thing going on again. Every time we seem to get some type of settle or stability, someone from City Hall or PDC or someone else decides, well, it's time to move them again. As an example, Fred Myers used to be probably an anchor in terms of providing services in this community, and it's located at that particular time and for many years, ever since I was a child, on what is now King Boulevard, at that time Union Avenue and Killingsworth. It's now gone. There used to be a Keno's store, a market here. Keno's, I don't believe they're even in business anymore. There was a trade well. Then it turned into a More for Less? It's gone. And you can see these places. This is on Killingsworth, right before you get to the freeway. On 15th and Fremont, that was replaced by another store. So there was a big shopping complex up there with a grocery store. And now it's New Seasons or one of those. Now, there were also, during that particular time, grocery stores, what we would consider mom-and-pop grocery stores, but they were owned by African-American people at the time. Neighborhood Bills down on Williams and Tillamook. And right across the street, the Elks Club was there, and I'm told now that that's been sold as well. And that was a place where there was a lot of dancing and music, and they had a bar in there, and they had a meeting room. They had Paul's Paradise. Going back even before that, in my father's day, you had Mysterious Billy Smith's and the Frat House, places like that. That's down by where the Coliseum used to be. Then they moved it up. So this community has continually been moving and change and moving and change and moving and change. It parallels my life of moving from pillar to post. And so I think when I look at me as an example, that's really the story of what's been happening to most of the black people ever since the flood. Now you got the same phenomena happening over again. And what's so interesting about this, as we are the ones that are moved, the businesses that take over where we are not black businesses.
You're listening to an interview with historian Obi Hill on Circle A Radio.
When you have a group of people, such as the Africans who were introduced into the Americas, forcibly brought here to provide a certain function, which was basically to be used as a disposable labor force, enslaved, captured and kidnapped and enslaved and made to work for a specific purpose during the infancy of this country, nobody thought in the greatest stretch of the imagination that these people would survive. I mean, after all, this was a brutal century after century use of this particular let's say, human resources to build this country. After the so-called Civil War, and I don't know what was so civil about it, these people were told that they were free. And in addition to that, they were told that they were citizens. They were given citizenship without even acknowledging whether or not they wanted to be citizens. When people such as Marcus Garvey decided it would be best for us to return to Africa, you had people like the Firestone Corporation able to make sure that that didn't happen because of their interest in rubber trees. Then this man Garvey is expelled and placed in exile, so now the Back to Africa movement is stalled. But the population itself keeps growing and expanding. So the idea of limiting the geographical terrain or of where these people can live and operate was decided, and that was to segregate them and to build housing and maintain patterns based on race. As my father and other people came up here to take advantage of opportunities because of labor shortages, most of the people in this particular plan had it envisioned that after the war, these people would return to the South. But those people made a conscious decision that there was nothing to go back to the South for. So they stayed up here after the war. Then you had a flood. But still, tenaciously, some of these people said, "We will start all over again." So in the history of the United States, as it relates to African people, we have been continually the ones who have received instability for all the work we've done in the United States of America. This whole thing of instability among certain populations, the African American population has been the most unstable population in the United States, not only here in Portland, in the entire United States. It appears that every time you get a little settlement and some consistency or continuity going, someone comes up with a relocation plan. Now, it might be a freeway, it might be a hospital, who knows what else. As an example, When the Memorial Coliseum, the so-called ER Center, was planned, it displaced primarily African Americans. Then when they moved up farther, then I-5 came, so they built a freeway, and then we were moved again. That's Interstate 5. Interstate was the highway. Then they needed a freeway. So they built what they called, and you don't hear referred to this now anymore, that is the Minnesota Freeway. So then they built the Minnesota Freeway, which is now I-5. It meant that the black people then could cross 7th Avenue up to 15th. So then you got people, 15th Avenue was the barrier. But then they spilled over into the Grand District. Because at that particular time, the majority of the black people in the city of Portland went to two high schools and feeder schools. And that was Jefferson High School and Roosevelt High School. And you might have had a handful of people at Washington. And few people went to Benson, and there was a girls' polytechnic. They had a few out there. But Jefferson and Roosevelt was basically the two schools, the high schools that we went to. And all the other elementary schools in the area. You couldn't go to any school. You had to go to the local school. Well, in this moving, now we see Emmanuel Hospital coming up again. We were told at that time, first of all, before Emmanuel took over, there was rumors that it would be the Veterans Hospital. And so the Veterans Hospital decided to build up on the hill. Then Emmanuel came and took that. That particular area right on that block was the heart of the black business community at the time. You had Top Q, a Slaughter's Pool Hall. That's where you had a couple of nightclubs there, Citizens Restaurant, a pharmacy. And all in that area is where black people had their cultural hub, so to speak. Okay, then once that happened, they moved that, and then there was a shift again. I think that what you're going to see for the next 20 years is basically people going into the commercial nubs or intersections and districts and building the blocks with new businesses, housing being remodeled in the area, few row houses being stuck up in certain places, other things torn down. And what they're doing now with the black people is like warehousing them in apartment complexes, low-income housing. So you don't have the mix of various income groups within the community. As they're scattered out, then startup couples or businesses come in, buy up the houses, and put in new businesses. So, yeah, so we are now being, it's like Chancellor Williams said in his book, The Destruction of Black Civilization, where you scattered people throughout Africa. And then once that settled down and they got settled, then colonialism came in. So then everybody divided it up, and here you go scattered again. So you got African people speaking Portuguese, you got them speaking French, you got them speaking English, you got some of them, I don't know. It's that type of a thing. And it's been happening. So it's just not Portland, it's the world, wouldn't you say? So gentrification, or what they used to call urban renewal or Negro removal, I've seen all of my life, whether it was a natural disaster or a city hall plan. There are other aspects of this too. The police have a function, but drugs and other things have also played a major part in instability in black and other so-called minority communities. When you go back and you look at the crack epidemic that came through here, all of this is a way, as a means of also paving the way for the new pioneers. So-called gang or gang-related activity gives a justification for more sufficient or efficient use of the police mission in these neighborhoods. So there's a multiplicity of things that adds to this phenomenon called gentrification. And you can't blame people for taking advantage of opportunity, you see. What I'd like to reiterate is there a multiplicity of things that lead up to, there are prerequisites and requisites lead into the final outcome of what in the 50s they called urban renewal or Negro removal. Now it's gentrification. I don't know how the French got it here, but and it's happening today. But people don't see it because most people don't draw a historical continuum so that you can parallel this, and they want you to see it in little bits and pieces but not put it all together. But this is nothing new. So we're out here sort of still in the wilderness trying to find our way. And me personally, I've seen this all my life, and for whatever is left of it, my children have seen it, and now my grandchildren seen it. So we're in our fourth generation out here now. I don't know if they make a decision to stay here or move elsewhere, but my grandmother, my parents, me, my children, and my grandchildren, that's five generations of hills that have been in Oregon, in Portland. For what it's worth, I see continually the same thing happening over and over again here in Portland for black people. And that's not to say that there won't be any here, because there are going to be people who tenaciously, like myself, hang on to making sure that we carve out a place for us. Because if not here, then where? Yeah, it's nothing wrong with the Pacific Northwest. It's you know, a little rain, but so what? In each life, a little rain must fall.
Obie Hill, owner of Reflections Bookstore.
Reclaiming Our Origins Through Struggle, Roots, is a grassroots organization fighting for racial justice and liberation of people of color. Roots' mission is to empower people of color with an emphasis on building the leadership of grassroots people of color, develop youth and adults of color to be the leaders of tomorrow by teaching ourselves about our rights, our history, and empowering our community to demand what's rightfully ours. Challenge institutions through direct action organizing to be accountable to our community, and build a broad-based revolutionary movement for racial and economic justice with an ultimate goal of liberation of people of color. This is Charles Bishop.
Roots is, we're not so much a militant group, but we're a group that wants to take action. And militant is sometimes given to people because they go against the status quo. We're just trying to preserve ourselves. And we all know that preservation of self is one of the first laws of life. And for some people, just my household, raising my family, is enough to fight for, to shed tears, sweat, blood for. The work is good because we're not trying to recreate our rules. We're trying to learn from our elders. They have put in place institutions, systems, and steps for us to follow. They put a template together that worked. What happened is we became divided. So what Roots did, in the first 2 years, we were very open in our forums. It was a very communal place. We would discuss, as we're doing here, with all cultures and races, race matters. What we're shifting into is we have to scale back, not because of numbers. What we're realizing that if we're going to be effective and stick to our mission statement, it must be specific to Black people. And the reason that is because we are the ones that are not making those choices to better ourselves. So why is that? How can we fix it? And how can we move on together? Whether you're African-American or a person of African descent of means or not, we have to share this information. We have to respect and listen to our elders. The elders need to work with these young people, such as ourselves. As I do my daughter, sometimes I put my hand on the back of my head when she's not going the right direction, and I just guide her in the right direction. And we need our elders to do that with us. If we march with us, or show us the right way to march that will make a difference. And just like they did with Sister Kendra James, may she rest in peace, they marched for a while, and now you haven't heard nothing. With James Perez, I went to school with this brother. He was a real good brother. He was a family man. We yelled, we shouted for a few days, and now the fire's gone. That is tearing us down because we start something, we stop. People are getting tired of that process. And Roots is saying, well, we're going to start with us, locally, small. We're going to build and grow and expand. We do have programs that offer the opportunity for others to come in, but if we don't take care of home, then when we try to branch out, our base is not stable and the foundation is not laid, the building and the structure will fall. And we can't afford that. The ball has been dropped too many times. And that's no diss to my elders, because if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be in this studio right now. But for the simple fact that our Black elders in the city alone, we're not talking about the Martin Luther King, I'm not talking about Megger, I'm not talking about Malcolm, I'm talking about our Ron Herndons, I'm talking about our Tony Hobsons, who's put together great programs. I'm talking about these brothers and sisters, Lenita Duke, who did something maybe years ago. That moment was great, but it didn't maintain its longevity. We need something that will fight the current institution that's in place, that will say we want change. And we don't just want it for a day, we don't just want it for a month, we want it for a lifetime, we want it for generations to come.
This is Angel Williamson of WAR, White Allies Against Racism, a subset of Roots.
I became involved with WAR actually through a series of like discussions and challenges that I experienced with some coworkers I worked with at a social justice organization here in town. It came up over months and months of struggle within the organization when the people of color within the organization were feeling like they didn't feel like they were getting the support that they needed to do their job well and to ensure that the organization was being true to its mission. People of color in the organization were experiencing the struggle, and you know, I had no idea at the time that this was even going on, and I was, you know, white person trying to do my thing and keep myself supported within the organization and feeling isolated within my own position and within the organization. And it wasn't until we all started communicating about our similar experiences, and then it started to become clear to me that, well, one, I didn't want to be a continuing part of the problem within the organization. I wanted to support people of color within the organization and also members of the community. And I didn't really know where to begin. And it was really the staff of color within the organization that said, well, come with us. Let's talk about this. Let's see what we can do. They'd been working on ideas and ways to go about the work in a manner that they felt was more accountable to the community and that they could proceed with more integrity. We were actually unable to realize all their ideas, all the work that they wanted to do within the organization that we really thought would make a huge difference. But we tried to carry that work away from the organization. We were unable to continue there. Even in that point, through all that discussion, and we're building these relationships with each other, we're realizing that we're having some really intense discussions, looking at the power structure of the organization that we were working in. We wanted to do something different. We kind of wanted to flip that power structure. That's how Roots came to be and the Prime organization, and how WAR, the White Ally, remained a project of the organization and not its own organization. It was just like recognizing that white people are predominantly the ones that are making the decisions, or were giving the resources out and choosing how those resources were being used, where the direction was going for the organization. We were trying to flip that. White people, you know, our role within Roots and within a lot of struggles around race are to act as support. And that might mean raising money. That might mean whatever tasks needed to be taken care of that day. Maybe not storm in the streets, but stepping back and giving whatever resources that we have and that we're asked to give at that moment.
Again, Charles Bishop of Roots.
African Americans want to contribute to the community. We want to own our community. We want to help change our community. We don't want someone just to sit there and give us a handout. That's just not in us. But when we're not allowed to reach up, to pull ourselves up, that becomes an issue for me, and that becomes an issue for a lot of people. We must all understand that equality, livability, human equity is given to everybody that's born on this earth. When one of our steps is taken to progress forward at the despair of someone else, I think that's an injustice. When you're dumping something in the river that's going to kill someone else, but it's cheaper on you to dispense of it that way, that's an injustice. So whether you want to go that route or go the other, there's a lot going on that, for me, we allow to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's because our elders made that move. They handed off the baton. Some of us didn't grab it. Some of them just got tired of trying to hand it off.
That's just the way it is.
Yeah, but we can't settle for that, because complacency will kill everybody.
Charles Santos of Roots.
The end result of gentrification starts with the blighting of a neighborhood. You pick your neighborhood anywhere in the USA, and you refuse services, sanitation services, social health care services, employment services, all these things to dilapidate a neighborhood. And over time, and it doesn't take a lot of time, the neighborhood looks like it's, the result of disuse. The sidewalks are crumbling and the buildings are crumbling, and after a while you start seeing the people are crumbling. And you have drugs because of disenfranchisation, you have crime because there's no jobs, I have to make money somehow to feed my kids. Then they see this and say, oh, this neighborhood needs to be revitalized. So after that, you have your plan for so-called urban renewal or revitalization, to where they come in and say, oh, we're going to clean this neighborhood up. So then you have outside corporate money or private money who comes and buys the property. Since it's been so dilapidated, it's sold for cheap. The property's cheap, the land is cheap. Worse than inexpensive, which is a value. Cheap is just dirty. So I buy this cheap land, and now that I have this cheap land, I'm gonna take my blueprint that I had planned for and make this into what they call these days, I guess it's multi-use businesses, where they'll have a restaurant or a bar or a video store or what have you on the bottom, and your rental space up top. After you have the urban renewal comes the gentrification, where the people will come in and have their businesses and have their new houses and have their new, whatever it is that's happening with them, move into the neighborhood. They come in with their families from out of state, sometimes from out of country, to move into this, what has been advertised to them as up and coming neighborhood. Once the media says it's up and coming, the people say that it's up and coming, and so the retail people who own all the realty will say, oh yes, everybody says it's up and coming, so now we have to raise our prices, make it as posh as possible, and move the right kind of people in, quote unquote. Then after that you have what is, your gentrification. Everything is new. You have trees growing, you have public assistance going for the people that are moving in. Oh, get comfortable. Here we have all these programs that are here for you that just came up. We have daycare places, your doggy daycare. In the end you have all the people that were in that neighborhood now move to another bad neighborhood. Because you can't move anybody in without moving somebody out.
Now, with the current changes on Mississippi, with the current changes on interstate, personally, I believe in economical development. I believe in growth and progress, but I just believe that all money's not good money, and you can bring more detriment to the community with your presence than you can sometimes help. On Mississippi, talking to some of the owners, they feel the tension. They'll tell you, we know there's no longer businesses of color on the street. And when they talk to you, when they're talking to a person of color that can address these issues, there's a nervousness and there's a tension, not calling them weak, not calling them the perpetrator, not calling them at fault. They know subliminally there is a frustration and a tension.
The onus is on the businesses that moved in because they didn't look to hire any people of color who were from the neighborhood. They brought in, like I said, they brought in their own workers. They say they feel tension. Well, some of that tension was created by them specifically. I mean, you knew you were moving into a neighborhood that was predominantly people of color.
I hear people say, it's just this rich community. So you go into it and you try to change it right off the bat. I mean, we already change it. You know, we walk down the streets, you buy a home, you rent. And then it's like, but no, that's not enough. Now I'm going to throw my rules out there, my expectations out there, and throw my privilege around some more.
Charles Santos.
Nobody that I know in my black community is going to go to the clog store. You know, nobody I know is going to go to the goth comic book store. You know, nobody I know eats pasta and wine too much. You know, you want to focus on the things that we do. I would want a health food store that was affordable. You got to be rich to eat healthy. I would want childcare for kids, for single parents, mothers and fathers who go to work. You know, I'd want after school programs for the youth.
But what people don't really understand is that the narrow-minded business mind is a way to say that when I walked down the Alberta, the Hawthorns, and the Mississippis, I see that people did not take in consideration the diversity and the beauty of the community.
How are you going to support the community? Just looking at even what businesses are you supporting? You know, where's your money going? There's no reason why there can't be some sharing of resources. If you're going to be there, be really mindful and be intentional about your choices, where you eat, where you shop, what businesses you support, even just about acknowledging each other. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine. She's black. She lives in northeast Portland, and she's telling me about so many white people in the neighborhood now, and she'll be on her porch, and no one acknowledges her. No one says hello to each other. You know, they just walk by her. Even that, it's like, we have to be able to look at each other in the eyes. You're there, and your neighbors are there. It's like, how can you not look at your neighbor and say hello? I mean, that's just a slap in the face to me, or worse. If you can't acknowledge who's living right next door, personally, I don't think you have any right to be there.
Again, Charles Bishop of Roots.
There's hate being taught subliminally to generation after generation. These generations that get taught the subliminal hate with the misunderstanding of African Americans and other communities of color make decisions and put things in place that will affect us towards our detriment and not towards our betterment.
Again, this is Angel Williamson of WAR.
One neighborhood's north and northeast Portland. You've got people who are buying up houses that families have rented for years and years and years. You know, those families have been paying rent, and all of a sudden, person comes into the neighborhood, snatches up that house, and evicts the tenants. That changes the community right there. I mean, you're breaking up communities that people have lived together for years and years, decades maybe. It's about race, it's about class, it's about people who don't have the resources to own their homes. I don't know the statistics, but I think that's happening like 20-fold in the north and northeast Portland, yeah. Just with the influx, and it's white, middle class, upper class people are coming in and disrupting these longstanding communities. I don't think a lot of people are going to really argue about betterment of a community, I mean, as far as like streets, money going into schools, money going into businesses, but it's like, who's really benefiting from that? Why can't the residents that have been there for decades, families have been there for decades, benefit from this? race is a charged issue. It's really charged here in Portland, everywhere. But I mean, just speaking from being in this city, I heard before I moved to Portland like 10 years ago, oh, you know, Portland's this progressive city. It's so liberal. It's this, it's that. What I see, it's like, it's so insulated. Even within the activist community, there's that comfort. There's that comfort zone. It's like you can say, and I do this too. You know, I'm trying to do something, but it's just never enough. White people have to constantly be challenging ourselves and constantly be uncomfortable. How many people actually do that, you know, to be uncomfortable all the time and really move beyond being defensive and move beyond feeling guilty. It's just destructive to, I think, myself as a person when I'm in that space. It's destructive, and it's not giving me, like, I'm not grounded to really be listening to somebody else when I'm just overtly concerned with how I sound or what I'm thinking or how I'm being perceived, you know. And it's still a challenge with me. I don't ever expect it really to change. I mean, this is ongoing work. I think we have to get beyond that initial guilt and defensiveness and be like, okay, well, why am I feeling this way? Or where is this coming from? How is this impacting my ability to have really honest relationships with other white people, people of color, people with just different backgrounds? It's like, this is just impeding all of us from really living in a really just society, fully human. And until we can kind of move beyond that, I don't think we'll really get too far.
Roots is looking back in the 1960s when they rioted on Albina, and back in the 1970s when the building of Memorial Coliseum and the expansion of Emmanuel, and say, okay, the system will continually move us, displace us at their convenience and at their whim. When the opportunity of progress has come into full view and they say, oh, we have allotted these dollars and we can start breaking ground, well, how do we get these people out? It's not really a question of how, it's just when. When they make up their mind and there's no one pulling their coattails saying, you need to put some more thought in this. You need to come talk to us. You're about to move us out of our nexus, out of our homes, out of our epicenters of life. You know, we just can't let you do that. That's what we have to get back to. And understanding how the political policy works, as you try to protest, as you try to make your voice heard in the public and political arena, is very key. A lot of people don't understand that process. It doesn't start or stop just with a vote. There's people you can call. You can go make appointments. You can knock on doors. You can write letters. Email. City councilman gets hundreds of letters every month. People write, they talk, they call, and it seems like it's the same people. Not our people, but the people who understand how the process is. And where do they get the information from? From generations of information being shared. Not just the sharing of the information, but seeing the success of, if I say something to this person, they're going to listen to me. African Americans don't have that confidence. I hate saying this, but we don't have that confidence in some of our own leaders of color, let alone into the system that's predominantly ran by older white men.
People have been organizing in North and Northeast, I mean, black people and low-income people, for decades. They've been approaching the city hall asking for these changes. It didn't happen. Institutionalized racism, that's why it's not happening. And that's why this money is going into the neighborhoods now, because of the white influx.
Roots gets information and we compile it to say, it's been archived, it's been put away, but it's not hid. We have to search and dig deep enough for it so you'll know. And once you know, what are you gonna do with it? And that comes the motivation part. We know there's tools out here, let's get access, because we don't have the access. But there's also, there's a poor Latino community, a poor white community, a poor Native American community, Asian Pacific Island does not have the same access either. So what we do and what we set in place will bring change not only for the black community, but we'll say, nope, you gotta do this for everybody. You gotta make the standard. Again, it goes back to policy where it affects us all. The community voice is no longer a threat. And we have to be able to be a threat again.
Roots is located at 5303 North Mississippi Avenue and can be reached at 503-288-4021. Their website, www.rootspdx.org, is currently under construction. To contact WAR, White Allies Against Racism, email Angel Williamson at angel.willimson@pcc.edu.
Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio this evening. We have some special thank you shout outs. Thank you, Kristen Crandall, Iggy Apparatus, Sarah Buckley, Becky Patchett, and the Oregon Jewish Museum, Charles Bishop, Charles Santos, Obi Hill, Angel Williamson, and all of you listeners who became members during KBOO's Fall Pledge Drive. We have a few announcements we'd like to make tonight. Do you understand what a grand jury is and how it can be used against you? The Grand Jury Roadshow is coming to your community. Grand jury investigations have recently been used to harass and jail people from the Black Liberation, Animal Liberation, and Environmental Justice movements in San Francisco and San Diego. This Grand Jury Roadshow will be happening on Saturday, October 8th at 7 p.m. at Laughing Horse Books and Video, which is located at Southeast 37th and Division. Tuesday, October 18th, join Judith Arcana, local writer and activist, as she reads from her new book, What If Your Mother? Judith was a member of the abortion counseling service known as Jane, an underground feminist clinic in Chicago that helped more than 11,000 women and girls get safe abortions before the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973. She'll be reading from her new book on Tuesday, October 18th at 7 p.m. at Broadway Books, located at 1714 Northeast Broadway. Call 503-284-1726 for more information. Circle A Radio comes to you every first and third Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. Contact us at info@circlearadio.org. We love feedback. This ain't living.
everybody thinks we're wrong. Mother, who are they to judge us? Mother, mother, simply call us we wear our hair long. Mother, mother, ooh.